Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud, as well as the content that we cover, it's not fraud. We actually give you the ground truth or ground zero as to exactly how the framers explained everything regarding this Constitution. So therefore, giving you the truth, giving you what you need to understand, gives you all the leverage in standing up and saying, you have no authority to be doing this, which is why we need you to act in that manner. So this is why we constantly have the three dots we connect: learn, pray, act. Everything that we are focused and trying to get you engaged with is about demanding full compliance of the Constitution. Don't complain if the laws aren't being followed and not being applied to protect you, if you're not demanding the rule of law to be restored, and that all laws, all legitimate, the Constitution and all of the legitimate laws be followed. Because as long as they can continually make up the laws, then they will continually, because as Thomas Jefferson said, ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country, because if you are ignorant, then they can pretend the laws and inflict a lot of pain. So, with that, let's welcome back Sean. And hey, Sean, we don't have Tammy today, by the way, folks. Unfortunately, Tammy is, she's just not here. So, anywho, so we're wrapping up the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, I think, Sean, you mentioned last time when we were saying goodbye to Tammy that she was going to miss the 25th Amendment.
Yes, that's a big one nowadays.
Yeah, okay. And it is a big one.
It should have been a big one, but it wasn't.
For Biden, absolutely, it should have been in play.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, but instead they found the auto signer?
Auto pen.
Auto pen, there you go. Thank you.
Did you see that where Trump put a picture of the auto pen as the presidential portrait in the White House?
No, but I think you mentioned that. I never saw that, but I think you did mention that and the humor that came from that. But anyway, so the 25th Amendment is something that was proposed in 1965 and ratified in 1967. Now, for the most part, when you look at these amendments, it seems like it only takes 2 years for them to be ratified. So one has to ask, why do they keep on putting, 7 years or a 5-year expiration? Why would they do that? Unless they really don't think it's going to get ratified? If they don't think it's going to get ratified, then why even submit the amendment? Other than, I'm going to put a check in the box from the people that have been paying me checks to do these things. So anyway, but let me even say this. For Congress to actually get an amendment out to the states, it requires 2/3 of both houses. Why would they sign off on an amendment that couldn't fly the muster? Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. All right. So this one right here, again, is the administrative process as to what to do when a president dies. And who was in office? This was actually... Nixon was in office at the time. Or hold on here. No. This was in response to, I guess, Kennedy. Because after Kennedy's assassination, there was really not a very good detail to succession. And they actually added a lot of other things to this. So let's dive into what this does and what they added to it, besides just the succession of a president dying. So go ahead with Section 1.
Section 1. In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president.
Okay, so that's kind of clear. That didn't change anything. I guess it was necessary to put into, you know, pen and paper. I don't know. Go ahead with section two then, next one.
Just right off the top of my head, when I read that, the first thing I thought about was when Nixon resigned and Ford became president, and wasn't he on the Warren Commission and had a hand in all of that?
Who, Ford?
Right.
Well, I don't know if Ford was, but that was 10 years after this amendment.
Right. Yeah,
okay, okay.
Well, I mean, Nixon was in 72, right?
Well, yeah, but Nixon didn't step down until into his second term. And okay. He was elected in 68 and then reelected in 72. And I think he resigned somewhere around 75. After
okay, section two.
Yeah, go ahead, section two.
Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses of Congress.
Okay. So by a majority vote. Interesting. Because when we look at the Electoral College, I guess that's pretty much by a majority vote as well, isn't it? Is it? Because 270 is the current. And if you double 270, that makes it 540, right?
Right.
Okay, so technically there's 545 seats?
Oh, and that includes the territories in Washington, D.C. You have representatives that have electoral votes too, right?
I think only D.C. does. I think that there are representative, token representatives. Like
right, when, they're non-voting.
Correct, they're non-voting, right? So they're there to be involved, to provide feedback back to the territories, but for the most part, they're non-voting. And so I know that it's, you know, out of the 100, there is 345 seats in the House, or in the House portion where they would sit. And so when they have the body of the whole come in. And so I believe that those seats that are occupied by the Solomon Islands, is it Solomon Islands? Samoa.
Puerto Rico.
Samoa. It's Samoa, it would be Guam, it would be, you know, those types of places where there is a token representation. Puerto Rico, another one, you're correct. Okay, so As we look at this majority vote, and I'm looking at the 270, that would take, because that takes, that's shy of the 545, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean 435, I think it said 345. So, yeah, I'm just kind of curious as to why the Electoral College hasn't been bumped up, because it seems like a simple majority. Anyway, and I don't like simple majorities, but it's not simple majority by number count of votes. Because if you really look, like Wyoming gets, you know, for less people, they get full three votes in comparison to some of the other states that have only three votes, like the Dakotas. Anyway, because they've got more people, more citizens in those states than Wyoming does. But anyway, let's go into Section 3.
Section 3. Whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president.
Sorry about that. So who is the president pro tempore?
The Senate leader.
So currently,
I would say the leader of the majority in the Senate.
Well, so actually they have to elect that person. And currently that's Charles E. Grassley, the president pro tempore. In other words, the vice president is the kind of like the president of the Senate, but he's only a voting member when there's a tie.
Right.
So technically,
so what is John Thune?
He's just a senator. Now, so they have these party designations like the whip, majority whip, minority whip, and so forth. So they have those types of designations of play of power, but that's party power.
Right.
But remember, there should be no party involved in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. There's no latitude in the Constitution for them to have to be accountable via the party. They are only accountable via what? Now, most people would say their constituents.
Okay.
But actually, they are only accountable to the Constitution, right? Because when they take an oath, that's what they have to support. There's nowhere in their oath that they have to support their constituent. It was deemed that while they're supporting the oath or while they're supporting the Constitution, they are directly supporting their constituents. Now, it would be ill advised.
We may have to choose the president if the Electoral College can't choose. And then it says they have to go by the states, but the states get one vote.
Yeah,
according to the quorum.
Yeah. So that's the House of Representatives that choose the president. Right. And that, again, is by delegation. So in other words, the state of California, they don't have a popular vote. Right. And so that mode I prefer, because I believe that we need to water down. I don't want to say that, but I believe we need to realign the Electoral College to where it is not necessarily representative of population, but more representative of the states. Because I believe each state has an equal voice. The whole point of the Senate was to ensure that there was equality. The reason why, when it goes to in the 12th Amendment, when it goes into the House of Representatives, and each house or each state only gets one vote, that, to me, was the essence of the whole design of how to get there. But people wanted to be able to feel like their vote would count one way or the other. I get it.
I guess the question that I had was, mm-hmm. a lot of people were talking, and I think we've talked about this as well, that if it would have came down to an electoral count in the House of Representatives and they had to vote by states, mm-hmm. that Trump was going to win because...
Yes, he would have, because...
Red County, so that goes by party then, right?
Well...
So what were they talking about when they said that the states would only have one vote according to the majority in... I'd have to look at the exact wording, but you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So the reason that Trump would have won is because those states there were that many red states that in the delegations, in every one of the delegations in the House of Representatives, there was a majority of Republicans in each of those states. Now, Wyoming, there was only one person in that delegation. That was Liz Cheney, and she would have voted against Trump.
Right.
I'm serious. She would have voted against Trump.
Oh, I know she would have.
But I believe that the South Dakota, North Dakota, and some of these other single delegations, and that's the amazing thing. I mean, smoke on that, California. You know, the state that had the most at that point in time representation in the Senate or in the House of Representatives, they had more representatives, and they only got one vote that was equal to this one person that was representing that state. That is, I believe, the most balanced way of ensuring that the union is being represented, not the population centers.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you really look today, when you've only got 7 or 8 states that have high population centers, then, you know, it completely marginalizes. By using a popular vote, it completely marginalizes the union. That makes sense, right? Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. So Let's do section 4.
All righty. I'm sorry, I was checking.
It's okay.
12th to look at what I was talking about.
I jump around too.
Right, we're on 25.
25, section 4.
And section 4.
Let's take a
whenever
break
the vice
paragraphs.
President
let's
take and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the President pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting President.
Okay. So I was hoping to get a pause between the paragraph here. That's okay. So we got it. We got the pause. So what is the metric? In other words, what they're saying is either the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body of Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of the Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable. So what is the metrics to being unable to discharge his duties, his powers and duties? What is that metric?
I'm sure there's a list of things.
You would think that this could easily be played out if you had a party has the president in there, then because there's different ways of doing this, and you see the Congress or as a body in Congress, because they talk about the vice president can do this, the principal officers of the executive departments can do this, or such other body as Congress may by law provide. So let's just say you've got a Republican president, and you know the vice president, they're all happy. The president's executive team, they're all happy. But Congress isn't so happy about this. Congress isn't so happy about what the president's doing. And now Congress has this ability to create a body to say, we want you to find him unfit so we can remove him. Does that make sense? I mean, is that not an avenue? Because that's what they say. There's these three avenues. The vice president can do this, and a majority of the principal officers. Or, so it's those two people that are in the president's corner, those two groups, or a body as Congress may provide by law. So it means that politics could be in play here.
Yeah.
Right? Definitely. Okay. All right. I just wanted to make clear here that it seems like this was created down the road because maybe they felt that the separation of the parties between the president, the administration of the president, as well as Congress, by being so polarized that we could actually see Congress try to perform what this would be deemed as a coup. Unless there's a metric. Does that make sense? A metric being, what is the measure of his incapacitation? Do you have to have doctors that say this? Do you have to have a physical where, you know, he actually can't touch his, you know, fingers to it, like a sobriety test? He's not cognitive? I mean, if the president seems to be and is refuting, hey, I can do my job. What are you talking about? This actually bypasses his say in this completely. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's why I go, you know, why did they put this in here? And so let's go into this other paragraph, because I know this is where the president can basically, you know, say, hey, I'm ready to come back. But that doesn't mean he's going to come back. Why didn't they give the president a shot up front to say, hey, hold on here. This is completely out of order. Anyway, let's go ahead and pick up the second paragraph on this.
Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the vice president and majority of either the principal officers of the executive department or such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit within 4 days to the president pro tempore of the Senate and speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge his powers and duties of his office.
Okay, hold on right there, if you could. Okay, so we see that the president can actually transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House a written declaration that he that no inability exists. He shall resume his powers. So in other words, he shouldn't have actually lost his powers in the first place. As a matter of fact, I think what should happen is if the vice president and the executive or Congress, whichever the two sides of, you know, want to pursue this, goes to the president pro tempore to say, hey, we want to remove him. I think the president pro tempore should actually go to the president and say, you're being shut down because they say they're unable to do your duties. Are you aware of that? Because all they then would have to transmit and say, I'm completely capable of my faculties and doing my duties. And that way the president shouldn't actually be removed from duty or his position. Does that make sense? Because it right here it says that no inability exists. He shall resume the powers and duties of his office. So in other words, they can actually remove him first and then pass a bill.
I can't help thinking with the date of this that it had something to do with Kennedy. And I can see them thinking to themselves, well, we almost got caught murdering this president to get rid of him. Let's figure out a way to where we can get rid of the president if we don't like what he's doing. That's just my conspiratorial
thoughts. So this was done 2 years after his assassination, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I kind of see that point that maybe they wanted to put into play an ability to... And actually, this is the one thing that I see that could happen. Based on the way it's done, if Congress, keeping in mind that Congress is one of the paths of taking the president out of play, in other words, the president could be on vacation, the president could be out somewhere and not in office for a bill to come through to where, you know, they could actually bypass the president and have somebody else step in as the president, then the president can, no, I'm capable of doing this, but that bill's already come and gone. Does that make sense? So that's the one thing I can see that by removing him and having to wait for him to resume his powers would be in play because the temporary president could then sign it. And I think that that right there is a strategic play that could really, you know, help them do some bad things. But we're just talking about either one bill, two bills. I mean, there could have been a slew of bills that they could have all in prep, and the president thinking, well, I've got to go up to Camp David, you know, and or I'm going to be unplugged to, you know, into this conference and so forth. Because back in those days, we definitely did not have the communications we have today. And so I would think that this was more of a way of being able to skirt the president with still giving, you know, okay, if you can do your duties, we'll let you have the position back, but we've already done our damage by that point. Anyway, okay, so go ahead and pick it up from where you left off. And that's, thereupon Congress shall decide.
Thereupon Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours for that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress within 21 days after receipt of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session, within 21 days after Congress is required to assemble, determines by two-thirds vote of both houses that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall continue to discharge the same as acting president. Otherwise, the president shall resume the powers and duties of his office.
Okay, so we're going straight into break without the music, so we'll be right back, folks, right after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, sorry about that. So you just started reading, and we the go-to-break music started playing, the bumper music. So what I thought, I would just go ahead and pause that. And so obviously I need to do a little bit of editing, but it'll be, you know, it'll all be good. So, you know, you the listeners, it shouldn't be that bad. But I thought it was better to just let you finish reading this. Now, it seems, though, that what this is saying is that Congress shall decide the issue within 48 hours. Right? And that Congress will actually, by a two-thirds vote of both houses, that the president is unable to discharge his duties. In other words, they can actually make, this is where Congress has, and they give themselves a path to make a power play. The question is, would Congress ever have a point of two-thirds of both houses? I can tell you right now today, there's no way they would ever have two-thirds of the red states. And why I say that? Because currently, there's 30-some-odd red states that are out there. 30-some-odd. It comes to almost two-thirds of the nation, state legislatures, are red. So when we look at the House of Representatives, I can see that actually being there. Now, when we look at the party and how the party, because right now, how many Republican states have Democratic senators? Three states have two Democratic senators for each of them, and then there's other ones that have, you know, one here, one there. So, and we cover this, we go in why this is so important. I think that because there's this paradigm that the 17th Amendment actually allows the parties full control over the Senate, which constitutionally it doesn't, I think that this was probably a power play. In other words, I'm trying to feed your conspiracy theory, if you understand what I'm saying. Now, I'm not sure if you are aware, but you may be on mute right now. So just in case, you know, you want to pipe up. But does this feed your conspiracy theory, the 17th Amendment and all of this?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Because this amendment was an amendment that was driven by Congress, not by the states. And I think the way they tuck this in there, giving Congress the path of being able to remove, because that body that Congress shall make is, you know, defined by law, then voila, Congress now can actually create that and then create the argument that he's unfit, and if they have the votes in both sides. But here's the thing. This is all banking on the concept that the 17th Amendment has moved that part of Congress under this Democratic, or I should say, party globalist control. Not even Democratic, party globalist control. And the truth is, from that article, the truth on the 17th Amendment, it is not in play. I mean, the states need to take that back. There's no way that they could actually do this power play that they have in the 25th Amendment if, you know, they've tried to conspire, folks. This is why,
restoring the state suffrage in the U.S. Senate is paramount. It just makes sure that this could never happen. Anyway, so that's kind of interesting, right?
Absolutely.
All right, so the 26th Amendment is kind of interesting because this is the fourth and final, but notice that it still says the citizens of the United States. This is the fourth and final, I will call, voting amendment. In other words, making sure that the citizens cannot have their right, a U.S. citizen cannot have their right to vote, to be disparaged because of race, because of sex, because of a poll tax, and now this one is on age. So go ahead and let's pick this one up.
Section 1, the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age.
Okay, so what that means is that 18 years of age people are able to actually vote. I understand that the intent and the argument, you're probably old enough to remember this amendment, right? Almost? Almost? Okay, maybe not.
No. I remember the Nixon saga barely, but it was such a big deal. But as far as this getting passed, I don't
know. Okay, so being the youngest in the family and not being affected by voting by this, you know, by this one amendment, but being the youngest in the family, I had, you know, a couple of siblings that were already through high school, already 18. And a few more siblings were going through that. And so I remember that this was a big deal. And I remember my father, and you know, took a huge risk with as many kids as he had to say, I don't think our kids should be able to vote until they're 21. And he says he still has a problem with that because a person shouldn't really be able to vote until they have an appreciation for the effects of government. And understand, you know, what the consequences are if you vote one way or you vote another way. Because it could seem really good and interesting. You know, we're one election away from a large mass of idiot kids from passing an amendment or passing, you know, or passing an election of allowing some terrible thing to happen. Because, boy, wouldn't that be great? And have no idea the ramifications and how it's going to affect them, too. I don't know if this makes sense, but...
Oh, it makes sense, considering the election results yesterday.
Right. Well, so we see kids being weaponized by the school system and trying to take away the rights for vote, you know, guns and all of these types of things. Now, even though most all of the elections that occurred yesterday were at state level, most all of them, state and local levels, it's interesting that the way it's being spun is the Democrats are, you know, they're back. The Democrats are back. There's still this little problem that all of America didn't vote yesterday. And it's not like Congress was up for re-election. This was not a true midterm election. So the reality that has been kind of being presented is that there's this continuation of Democrats abandoning the Democrats and becoming Republicans. Now, I got a question. Is that something that is good? Because when I see Democrats changing their party affiliation in the state of Wyoming, and some of these other red states, I don't necessarily think that's a good idea, because how do we know that those Democrats, you may be gaining more registered voters, and they may be abandoning that, but that may be actually that they're just trying to infiltrate so that they can have a bigger impact in the primary process.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern.
Okay, all right. So, you know, the way they report, the way they kind of present the information, one would think that it's just, you know, their analysis is spot on. But I I've gotten to the point where I just don't trust anybody in what they're trying to tell me, especially when it's coming from mainstream media, whether that be conservative or not. Okay, so so the real drive behind this was the Vietnam War was going on, and there were two major issues. Draft, the draft was one thing, because people did not want to be fighting in this war. The argument to go into this war, which in a way I agree with, not constitutionally agree with, but I do agree that communism is a cancer that will continually, you know, infect, it'll cross over one boundary or one border to the next, to the next, to the next. It is, it's like Islam. It wants world domination. It wants to create a communist world government, just like Islam. And so we can't marginalize the threat that communism has. The best way to eliminate communism is to get out of the UN, stop funding communism via the UN and all these other alliances that we have. So we're funding all of this. So we got to stop funding all of that and open up the process of the process exists, but start soliciting to good states to say, if you want to join the union, come on in. You know, you'll have to go through this process, but once you're there, then you'll become a part of this union. Once a state is in the union, there's no way they can flip to communism, because the requirement of supporting the Constitution is paramount. It is the supreme law of the land. And so no state can actually invoke communism, like the redistribution of wealth and those types of things. Because the Constitution protects everybody's property rights. It protects everybody from the state. And so you can't invoke a statist government. The problem is we're not supporting the Constitution. This is why, in the beginning of every one of my shows, I say this is all about full compliance of the Constitution. You want to get rid of these Islamic states in the United States and deport these folks, we've got to get compliance to the Constitution. The Constitution will do that. Because the folks that came in here didn't come in here legitimately. The federal government has no authority to import persons. So, I mean, it's if we're following the Constitution, we can undo all of these. These are warfare tactics. The federal government has been playing these types of tactics against the states and we the people. So as I look at what the Constitution offers and I look at where we are, and back in these days, the communism was a real threat. As a matter of fact, in 1962 or 1963, when it was W. Cleon Skousen's, you probably never read his book, The Naked Communist. But in that book, he had 45 goals of communism in America to do this, 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 and this. And some of those things would, you know, were absolutely unconstitutional. And some of those things were, you know, the fact that the federal government was doing them, that they didn't even have the constitutional authority to do, but they wanted to, you know, basically take some unconstitutional thing and make it, you know, equally unconstitutional, but it would be favoring communism. So anyway, that 45 goals was actually entered into the congressional record. And so, I've cited that in my first book. But the point is that when you look at those goals, almost all of those goals they have attained by now. So anyway, I don't think people realize that the best protection from a tyrannical government like Islam and the best protection from communism is not the parties. It's not the Republicans or the Democrats. It's the Constitution. So let's dive into this next amendment. This is the 1972, I believe this is the Equal Rights Act. And actually, it's not an Equal Rights Act. It's the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA. And so let's go ahead, because this was unratified, or I should say it expired in 1982, because it was no longer capable of being ratified.
Section 1, Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
Okay, so let me ask you this. What does this do that the 14th Amendment doesn't do?
That's first thought in my head was, why is this even necessary?
The equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. In other words, they're basically saying that they want to create a protective status on sex. See, the 14th Amendment protected the rights of the citizen, could not be abridged, period. But when you create the protection, because when you read the 14th Amendment, it doesn't say anything about race. It says that the rights of the citizen shall not be abridged. The privileges and immunities shall not be abridged. So if a woman is actually having, or a freeman, or a black, or a Hispanic, or anybody, even a white German, if they're having their rights abridged because of some state and some state law that they're enforcing, then the Constitution protects them from that. The Jim Crow laws were unconstitutional. Creating segregation was unconstitutional. And so what they were trying to do, because when we look at the Civil Rights Act, which was unconstitutional as well, the Civil Rights Act created this perception that the federal government needed to protect demographics. In other words, they went, and as a matter of fact, it was carried further forward in not only protecting, but taking a proactive action or being proactive in going in and I'll just say using resources, money, and so forth to assist advantages, to provide advantages for what was considered disadvantaged people. Well, there's no disadvantaged person under the Constitution. And the concept of, you know, equal protection under the law is equal protection under the law.
Period.
And so what really was the truth of the Civil Rights Act was this was an act to basically create reverse oppression and create a reverse advantage. In other words, to actually give an advantage to minorities and be able to oppress and actually have negative adverse effects on whites as much as they could. And I'm going, see, you know, it's just like, it makes me remember a friend of mine. Sorry for speaking in sentence fragments. A good friend of mine. We, you know, talked about, you know, race relations, these types of things. And, you know, he pointed out, he goes, you know, it's like that Star Trek. You know, that Star Trek episode where the two brothers were half white and half black.
Right.
But one brother.
On the right,
yes, correct. Left. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so he goes that it, you know, as human beings, we will go out of our way to figure out how we can be divisive and segregate ourselves from somebody else. And it's just like, these are things that are concocted in our heads. These biases are created in our heads. There's a lot of misinformation, absolutely a lot of misinformation that exists in the education system, or I should say, it shouldn't even be in the education system because it's not even academic. But these biases have survived. It's just like this whole crap that they've been teaching about hating, you know, our ancestors and hating what they did in creating the land of liberty.
It's just crazy.
And as a matter of fact, I remember going in my college courses reading textbooks that basically were stating that the United States created slavery.
Right? Yeah.
It completely ignoring the 3,500 years that Egypt, you know, had and was conducting slavery, and all these other great empires of the world, how they had slaves. And all these, you know, seven magic, or what do they call those, the seven wonders of the world? You know, like the Taj Mahal, the Great Wall of China. Guess what? Every single one of those things was built on slave labor.
Correct.
But you see academic, oh, these are marvelous things. That type of slavery was good. But right. the how we invented it, we're evil. We need to destroy ourselves. I mean, that's how backwards they are. But anyway, let's dive into this next one, Section 2.
Section 2, the Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article.
And
this amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification.
But they didn't include its expiration. That's interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now let's read the next.
So, how did it expire?
It was actually in the instructions. It wasn't in. It doesn't have to be in the part of the right. amendment. Okay.
I guess.
Okay. So let's go through the next one. Inoperative, proposed in 1798, expired and unratified in 1985.
Section 1, for purposes of representation in the Congress, election of the president and vice president, and Article 5 of this Constitution, the district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall be treated as though it were a state.
Okay, so you see what they're doing here? We talked about this yesterday, about how they wanted to create the District of Columbia as a state, and here it is. Here we go, and we're talking 24 years later. Well, let's see if we can get this one passed. So let's go ahead and do Section 2.
The exercise of the rights and powers conferred under this article shall be by the people of the district constituting the seat of government and as shall be provided by the Congress.
Uh-huh.
And so the Congress wanted their own state.
Yes, and they will be able to ensure that they, you know, have that control over that state.
Mm-hmm.
Section 3.
The 23rd Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed.
Okay. So what was that 23rd Article? It was just establishing the Electoral College. Okay. All right. And Section 4?
Section 4. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission.
Okay, so this one included the expiration as well, right? And so that's one of the things that saved us. And I think that even the wisdom that was existing back then probably had something to do with it as well. Because if people don't understand, there's a reason why the District of Columbia was not to be a state. They did not want a state to be able to control, one state, to have that level of control over our general government. They pointed out in the ratification debates that it was already an embarrassment when the state of Pennsylvania, actually, the people of the local area basically ran out Continental Congress because they knew where they were and they had the ability to just, hey, we don't like what you're doing. And they were accosted. So they wanted to make sure that that could never happen. Okay, so because a state, by the way, in the Union is sovereign. But what they're going, and one, there's, I believe, another operative part of this was to create the paradigm that the states were not sovereign, or they wanted to make that paradigm that they were actually subject to the federal government. In other words, the federal government was sovereign and the boss of all states, which is not the case. So let's read the 27th article.
Proposed 1789, ratified 1992, second of 12 articles comprising the Bill of Rights. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives have intervened.
Okay. So there's a lot of other little notes that were added, and those are notes that I maintained from John Rowland from the Constitution Society. So a lot of these things are pointing to either, you know, reference materials and so forth. And I think most all of these links are probably dead, but that being what it is, this wraps up the Constitution, or going through the Constitution. Therefore, what I'd like to do is and hopefully we'll have Tammy. She may not be in our next session, so our next show we won't have Tammy. So what I'd like to do is kind of wait until we have Tammy to kind of do kind of a review, because I'd like to go through, well, what is it you learned? And, you know, having gone through this, you know, page by page, line by line, Sean, what is it that, you know, jumped out to you that I did not know this, this, and these things? And, you know, is there other things that we might have learned or anything, any insights, what have you? That being said, what we're going to cover next, do you know what we're covering next as far as the, I should say, the curriculum?
Not offhand.
Okay, so when we cover the Constitution, let me find out where that is. I think the Convention, the Organic, the Constitution, Constitution, Convention, Madison's Notes, Ratification Debates. So what we want to do is we want to get back into what we haven't covered, because what we covered up to this point was literally the step-by-step from the Tory Acts, and then there was a lot of other little ancillary things and other commentaries of the day that we covered this past year. But we have not, and I've been holding off on the Assumption Act. I've been holding off on the Bank Act. I've been holding off on the cod fishery bounties. Now, actually, I think Tammy and I, or did you and I cover the cod? We covered the cod fishery bounties, didn't we?
We covered it, yeah.
Okay, so we covered that one, but we didn't cover the Assumption Act or the Bank Act. So that's what we'll be covering next. Then we're going to cover the Whiskey Rebellion. And then there's probably a few other things that we may want to cover, but then we'll probably dive into the five critical documents, because if I'm trying to go through the year chronologically, so what happened after 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion? Well, the Alien Sedition Acts was the next really big thing. So that kicked off a series of actions and documents that we need to go through, because this is Madison and Jefferson's, you know, how do you clean the dirty oven? You know, most people, they see that, you know, clean oven button, and they hit that, and then, you know, they come back and, huh, it's still dirty. It's not that simple. You actually have to get engaged. You actually have to do things to prep and so forth. And in this particular case, they actually go through the process, and it's called interposition. Interposition is where the states take the responsibility in forcing the federal government to comply to their compact. Now, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Sean, for coming on, and I appreciate your time and efforts and so forth. So with that, thank you again. And folks, when we come back, we're going to actually start steaming forward the Bill of Rights, because we've already covered the Bill of Rights. And because we've already covered the Bill of Rights as a part of Constitution Day, we'll just kind of mention the Bill of Rights Day coming up in December. But what I do want to do is I kind of want to go through all of the other little things that we haven't covered that take us into, like, the Missouri Compromise, Monroe Doctrine, that type of stuff, just to give you the final wrap-up. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.